Good morning, and welcome back to our listeners for our weekly series for the Virginia Mason Internal Medicine Residency Primary Care Curriculum Podcasts. That is a long, long title. Yeah. My name is Ananth Chernoy. I'm an outpatient internist, and I am joined by the illustrious teaching faculty, Dr. Michelle Lam. I will let her introduce herself.
Hello. Good morning, everyone. Excited to be here.
Well, we are very excited to have you back, and we will be talking about atrial fibrillation today, which is, of course, one of the things that we as internists, both on the inpatient and outpatient side, deal with a lot. Now, the learning objectives that Dr. Lam is going to be working through with us today are to be able to accurately diagnose and categorize atrial fib, to be able to determine and plan the workup for it, to be able to initiate appropriate therapy for both rate reduction and prevention of strokes, of course, including identifying those who need to be treated, and be able to refer the appropriate patients for consideration of those things like those antiarrhythmic drugs, ablations, cardioversions, and et cetera for treatment of atrial fibrillation, i.e. those who will get the most benefit from those interventions. So Dr. Lam, I think you have some background for us.
Yeah, so atrial fibrillation, as you probably know, is very common thing that we see. It's a major cause of morbidity and mortality with about 10.5 million cases in the U.S. and affects approximately 1 in 3 people in their lifetime in the U.S. and prevalence definitely increases with age. Atrial fibrillation is associated with a 5-fold increased risk of stroke and is estimated to cause 15% of all strokes. It also confers a 2-fold increase in all-cause mortality. In addition to stroke risk, it's also been associated with cognitive decline, including dementia. The causes for atrial fibrillation include both cardiac causes, such as ischemia, CHF, hypertension, structural heart disease, as well as non-cardiac causes like thyroid, pulmonary conditions, alcohol use, and medications. Patients are often asymptomatic approximately 50% of the time, or they might complain of symptoms such as palpitations, dyspnea, poor exercise tolerance, or fatigue. Diagnosis is usually based on ECG, so either with an ECG in clinic or an event monitor or loop recorder if the episodes are intermittent. And the main areas of treatment considerations for atrial fibrillation are 1, to prevent stroke or thromboembolism with anticoagulation, and then 2, rate versus rhythm control. There, we will get to this a little bit later, but there are also some updated guidelines for how we stage atrial fibrillation. I recall, you know, in the past, there's these terms of paroxysmal, persistent atrial fibrillation. And in 2023, like I said, there was a guideline update for the AHA and ACC that proposed actually 4 stages of atrial fibrillation to help guide management with actually a particular emphasis on prevention. So stage 1 includes all people at risk for atrial fibrillation. So that's anyone with risk factors, including obesity, family history of atrial fibrillation, alcohol use. Stage 2 is defined as pre-atrial fibrillation, where patients may have some atrial pathology often seen on ECG or an echo. So that includes left atrial enlargement, frequent atrial ectopy, or non-sustained atrial tachycardia, but they might not necessarily have a diagnosis yet of atrial fibrillation. These patients are considered pretty high risk for developing atrial fibrillation, as well as other associated cardiac and non-cardiac diseases like heart failure, coronary artery disease, valvular heart disease, hyperthyroidism, etc. Stage 3 is when you have clinically apparent atrial fibrillation, and this is where those terms subtypes come into play. So stage 3A is paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, where the episodes usually terminate spontaneously within 7 days. Stage 3B is persistent atrial fibrillation, so those episodes are lasting longer than 7 days and might require cardioversion to restore normal sinus rhythm. 3C is long-standing persistent atrial fibrillation, so that's continuous atrial fibrillation lasting greater than 12 months. And then they have this stage 3D category, which is atrial fibrillation that's treated successfully with an ablation. Stage 4 is permanent atrial fibrillation, where all interventions to restore sinus rhythm have failed or maybe haven't been attempted or have been foregone, maybe due to comorbidities. So The other emphasis with this guideline update is that treatment for all stages, with special attention again to those stage one and two individuals who don't yet have atrial fibrillation, is prevention with lifestyle and risk factor modification targeting obesity, physical inactivity, alcohol use, smoking, diabetes, and hypertension. So this is where us as primary care doctors can hopefully have a real influence in terms of trying to prevent atrial fibrillation from occurring. As we talked about, so that was a big evidence update with the new kind of staging of atrial fibrillation. There were some other key recommendations that came out of those 2023 guidelines, which are a change from before. The last kind of major update was actually from 2014, so things have changed considerably since then. So one key recommendation is that early rhythm control is recommended rather than trying a rate control strategy. Rhythm control usually includes antiarrhythmics or ablation. Similarly, performing ablation without first trying the antiarrhythmic drugs is also strongly recommended. Ablation for patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction specifically also received an upgrade to a class 1 indication. And use of left atrial appendage occlusion devices, this is like the Watchman, is now more broadly recommended. And in patients with device-detected atrial fibrillation, holistic approach to anticoagulation should be taken. So patients who have atrial fibrillation lasting longer than 24 hours should be treated as clinical atrial fibrillation. And for those where it maybe doesn't last quite 24 hours, decision is sort of based more on shared decision making and thinking about total density of atrial fibrillation and the CHADS-VASc score and discussing that with your patient. Similar to heart failure now, again, we are thinking about atrial fibrillation as more of a progressive disease classified on that continuum of progression like we talked about with the different stages of atrial fibrillation, with, again, risk factor modification and prevention being much more emphasized in these guidelines.
That's a really, really helpful overview and really a big change, I will just say again, because I've been in practice for 10 years, this has changed over a decade. Yeah. I think, as always, we also want to call out our health equity spotlight and disparities in care and our role in addressing them. So I think, Dr. Lam, you have some for us.
Yeah. So there are significant racial and ethnic disparities in atrial fibrillation. Black patients are less likely to be prescribed anticoagulation therapy compared to other racial ethnic groups. And they more often are prescribed warfarin instead of direct oral anticoagulants, which in general, those DOACs are safer and better tolerated. Additionally, Black patients with atrial fibrillation have higher risks of stroke, heart failure, and mortality compared to white patients. Hispanic and Asian patients also experience higher stroke rates and lower anticoagulant use compared to white patients. Sex-based disparities are also evident. So women with atrial fibrillation are less likely to receive anticoagulation therapy than men, even when their stroke risk is higher. And women also have a higher risk of ischemic stroke, but lower risk of heart failure and myocardial infarction compared to men.
Well, I appreciate that review. And just as a reminder, we all have a role in addressing that, both in our clinical practice and with our work in our communities. So we're going to jump to some cases, though, to start to apply this knowledge. And as a reminder, all these cases are completely fictional. There is no protected health information here. So our first case, Mrs. AF, which, by the way, great initials, is a 75-year-old woman who has hypertension and coronary disease status post of myocardial infarction 3 years ago, who is coming in today with concern for palpitation lasting minutes to hours without any associated lightheadedness or shortness of breath or chest pain. Her medications include lisinopril, metoprolol, and aspirin. She does not smoke, but does drink 1 to 2 glasses of wine about twice a month. Her blood pressure today in clinic is 145 over 90, and her heart rate is 105 and irregular. Her physical exam is only notable for the irregular heartbeat and, of course, the tachycardia, and she has no visible edema or JVD. So my first question for you, what are the risk factors and triggers for AFib?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about this, but risk factors can include cardiac risk factors such as hypertension, cardiomyopathy, valvular disease, particularly mitral stenosis, the left atrial enlargement that you can get with that. Non-cardiac causes, including pulmonary disease, hyperthyroidism, alcohol use, family history, and then acute conditions associated with atrial fibrillation include a myocardial infarction, pulmonary embolism, thyrotoxicosis, and a kind of post-operative state.
That's a really great reminder. So what is then the evaluation, the diagnostic evaluation for the seemingly nuanced onset atrial fibrillation?
Yeah, so I think doing a thorough history and physical, kind of looking for these risk factors and possible triggers, is important. Lab work, we typically start with a CMP, CBC, as well as a TSH, again, thinking about if hyperthyroidism is a potential trigger. And then we should be getting an ECG, especially for patients who have an irregular rhythm that we detect on exam, to confirm the atrial fibrillation, as well as look for other possible structural heart disease, such as left ventricular hypertrophy, bundle branch block, a prior myocardial infarction. Potentially, if the ECG doesn't show very much, you could also consider an event monitor to look at the burden of atrial fibrillation. And then finally, imaging. So we do usually recommend an echocardiogram to look for structural changes like the LV size and function, looking for that left atrial enlargement or possible pulmonary hypertension that may be contributing. And then finally, for these patients, again, with the evidence update, this is something I'm now more considering, is the cardiology referral, actually, to discuss possible early rhythm control, including ablation or antiarrhythmic drugs, which is a little bit of a change of practice, I think, for myself too, where we tended to favor more rate control early on.
Indeed, it kind of feels like kind of a seismic shift.
Yeah.
So you're able to get some of that workup going in clinic. The patient's EKG confirms the atrial fibrillation that you suspected. The labs are normal, including a normal TSH. You do get the echocardiogram rapidly, and it's normal except for moderate left atrial enlargement and a mild hypokinesis of the inferior wall, which was seen previously. An ejection fraction is 60%. My next question, does she need anticoagulation? And how might you go about deciding this?
Yeah, so we typically use the CHADS-VASc score. I think many of us are familiar with that to estimate the risk of ischemic stroke or thromboembolic events. And typically, if that risk is above 2% per year, that is when we want to initiate oral anticoagulation. That usually corresponds to a CHADS-VASc score of 2 or greater in men or 3 or greater in women. It's the CHADS-VASc score is widely validated, very accessible online if you just Google it. I know MDCalc has it and assigns different points for, you know, congestive heart failure, hypertension, diabetes, vascular disease, age, and female sex, as well as for any prior history of stroke or TIA or thromboembolism. In this patient, her CHADS-VASc score is actually 5, given her age, sex, history of hypertension, and history of a prior MI. So she should receive anticoagulation to reduce that risk of stroke and thromboembolism.
Absolutely. Which then leads to my next question. What type of anticoagulation would you recommend for her?
Yeah. So essentially in patients without any mechanical heart valves or moderate to severe mitral stenosis, DOACs are still preferred. They are associated with less bleeding than warfarin, and they also have a reduced risk of intracranial hemorrhage by approximately half compared with warfarin. There's no definitive, you know, randomized controlled trials that have directly compared one DOAC to the other. The American Geriatric Society recommends that due to higher bleeding rates compared with other DOACs, rivaroxaban should be avoided in adults older than age 65 with atrial fibrillation, except when once daily dosing may improve med adherence. For patients with renal failure who are receiving dialysis, both apixaban and rivaroxaban have been approved. In my practice, I find that insurance authorization and which one is, you know, most affordable to patients often determines access to the specific DOACs. In patients with atrial fibrillation who are eligible for oral anticoagulation and do not have a clinical condition requiring treatment with antiplatelet drugs, aspirin alone or aspirin plus clopidogrel are actually not considered to be effective and are harmful and shouldn't really be alternatives to the oral anticoagulant therapies. Importantly, compared with placebo, aspirin does not lower risk of stroke, but is associated with increased major bleeding risk. In this patient, you might recall she was taking a baby aspirin already due to her history of a prior MI. So I would recommend starting a DOAC and actually stopping that baby aspirin. Current guidelines recommend usually DOAC monotherapy over the DOAC plus a single antiplatelet agent in patients with atrial fibrillation and chronic stable coronary artery disease who have undergone coronary revascularization more than 1 year previously, unless that patient has a prior history of a in-stent thrombosis.
Great. I distinctly remember as a resident having conversations around this exact question many a time and debate in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So thank you for addressing that. Mm-hmm. So, next question. What treatment options should we consider for patients with a high bleeding risk or a history of a prior serious hemorrhage?
Yeah, so I know this comes up a lot too, and I remember learning about the Hasbled score. Apparently there's another score called hemorrhages, which can help determine bleeding risk. I think these scores have some limitations because they also incorporate factors that are associated with a higher stroke risk. For patients with a history of a spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage or history of recurrent bleeding requiring blood transfusions, the DOACs may be contraindicated. And so in these patients, this is where we consider more of those left atrial appendage occlusion devices, such as the Watchman device, to prevent stroke. Note that there isn't really direct evidence from randomized controlled trials actually comparing the benefits of this device to DOACs. It was actually, the FDA approval was based on randomized controlled trials that compared it to warfarin. And also note that with the implementation of the device, that does still require some anticoagulation. So at least 45 days initially after implementation of the device, followed by DAPT for 6 months and lifelong aspirin at 325 milligrams. So again, for patients that are nervous about taking a DOAC, this is an option, but they also should be aware that they will have to take some form of anticoagulation while getting the Watchman device placed.
Yeah, that's a really, really helpful point, because often what I have heard from my patients is anything that will help them stop bruising, they will go for. Mm-hmm. But if they're still taking that high dose aspirin, they're still going to bruise, right, as we know. My next question, what do you recommend for treatment for this patient in terms of rate versus rhythm control?
Yeah. So, you know, rate control, as we know, refers to slowing the ventricular rate with medication. So that's typically beta blockers or calcium channel blockers, such as verapamil and diltiazem. Rhythm control refers to interventions aimed to restore and maintain sinus rhythm. And that includes the antiarrhythmic drugs, cardioversion, and ablation. I remember hearing about, I think, the AFFIRM trial, which from 2002, there's also a study called RACE, which compared rate versus rhythm control, and those showed no significant differences in clinical outcomes, including mortality and stroke. However, there has been more recent data that has showed benefits of initiating rhythm control within 1 year of atrial fibrillation diagnosis, so what we refer to as early rhythm control, over rate control for reducing heart failure, stroke risk, or mortality, especially in patients with paroxysmal and persistent AFib, and as well as those with asymptomatic atrial fibrillation. Rate control, we generally reserve now more for patients who are unlikely to benefit from rhythm control or for whom rhythm control is considered too risky. And so that's for older patients who might have a longer atrial fibrillation history, those with permanent atrial fibrillation, low symptom burden, or poor efficacy of rhythm control, or if they have less LV dysfunction. In general, we should be favoring instead rhythm control for patients who are more likely to benefit. And so those are usually younger patients with a shorter AFib history, moderate symptom burden, and perhaps more LV dysfunction. When comparing ablation, like rhythm control with ablation versus antiarrhythmic drug, there has been some data that has looked at antiarrhythmic drugs that showed a benefit when initiated early compared to ablation or rate control. However, ablation has been shown to prevent recurrence of atrial fibrillation when compared to the antiarrhythmic drugs, which can lead to significant improvement in quality of life. And so in general, like we had talked about before, the ablation has been upgraded to that class one indication and generally is more preferred over the antiarrhythmic drugs due to improvements in preventing the recurrence.
So I know that has been a very significant change in evolution, mm-hmm, over the last few years, which I think has delighted cardiologists,
yeah,
honestly.
Yeah.
So getting back to this patient, yeah, so what would we do?
Yeah, so for this patient, I think it would be reasonable, you know, seeing her in clinic and having this, you know, has more new atrial fibrillation, it would be reasonable to increase her metoprolol dosage and closely monitor her symptoms and heart rate. However, I would also refer her to cardiology for consideration of ablation or possibly antiarrhythmic therapy. But also, again, thinking about the lifestyle, the factors, I would also recommend, you know, strongly avoiding alcohol use and focusing on improved blood pressure control. There have been studies that have shown benefits with regards to atrial fibrillation in terms of targeting lower blood pressures, systolics less than 120 compared to less than 140.
That's great. So kind of to summarize, we're thinking about the benefits of anticoagulation, again, using things like our CHADS2 vascular calculator. We're also thinking about for patients who are younger and have newer AFib and other signs of structural heart disease, we would want to look at rhythm control, preferentially over rate control, and in particular, ablations. So I think we have another case. Case number two, Mrs. KS is an 85-year-old woman with a history of dementia, hypertension, and a prior hip fracture due to a fall, who's coming in to establish care with you. She has a history of paroxysmal atrial fibrillation that was diagnosed during a hospitalization for pneumonia 2 years ago. Her medications include alendronate, amlodipine, metoprolol succinate, and apixaban at 2.5 milligrams twice a day. She's coming today with her husband, and they are wondering if it's truly necessary to continue with the apixaban. They note that the medication is quite expensive, and they're not sure they want to keep paying for it every month. So, how would you approach this difficult conversation about anticoagulation with this new patient?
Yeah. So, a nuanced discussion, you know, of risks, that includes the costs and benefits of anticoagulation, should be discussed with this patient. You know, you can calculate her CHADS VAS score, which is relatively high at 4, so she is at a high risk of stroke in the future. In terms of this question of, you know, patients who present with episode of atrial fibrillation during hospitalization, what does that mean for their overall atrial fibrillation burden? There was a study that looked at this in 2023 and found that 1 in 3 patients had recurrence by 1 year. This was done in Canada, included 139 patients who were hospitalized for a medical illness or non-cardiac surgery and developed these first episodes of transient AFib, and then they were followed with 14-day ECG monitoring at 1 and 6 months, as well as telephone follow-up. And so again, they found that 1 in 3 had developed recurrence. Importantly, the study didn't really look at the efficacy of oral anticoagulation for stroke prevention in this population, and there actually is a randomized controlled trial right now that's going on looking more at new onset post-operative atrial fibrillation. It's called the ASPIRE trial, and so maybe we'll be seeing data from that in the coming years, but I think similar randomized studies for hospitalizations just with medical illness is also needed. At the same time, remember, this patient had dementia, and there is some uncertainty around anticoagulation in the cognitively impaired and how much they benefit from this. In one study, there were 1,200 adults with atrial fibrillation who had a mean CHADS VAS score of 4.4. They were followed for 2 years, and anticoagulation was associated with excess major bleeding risk or death in cognitive impaired patients, but not in cognitively intact patients. So among the cognitively impaired, the number needed to harm with use of anticoagulation was 8, whereas the number needed to treat for stroke prevention was 30. And again, there was another study looking at 15,000 nursing home residents with atrial fibrillation and advanced dementia. These people had a mean CHADS VAS score of 6, so quite high. And anticoagulation was associated with significantly more serious bleeding, but not with lower stroke risk. And patients who received anticoagulation lived about 2.5 months longer on average, but more than half of patients really in both groups died within a year. So it was a pretty sick population that they were studying. So taken all together, you know, in this patient, really just need to have that shared decision-making with a thorough discussion of benefits and risks to help with determining whether or not to continue anticoagulation. You know, a 14-day cardiac monitor or an implantable loop recorder can be considered to help examine the possible burden of atrial fibrillation to try to help make a decision, especially if the patient is asymptomatic. But just remember that this may not necessarily truly capture the risk of recurrence of atrial fibrillation, given the limited duration of monitoring.
My goodness, that is a very helpful discussion, Dr. Mm-hmm. Lam. Thank mm-hmm. you. And also kind of another reminder that we also have a role in deprescribing, mm-hmm. thinking about particularly for our frailer patients and yeah. those with dementia with limited life expectancy.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty stark with an increased risk of bleeding mm-hmm. without benefit, mm-hmm. potentially. Mm-hmm. But thank you. This was a really, really helpful review.
Yeah.
And we're thinking about not only the diagnosis of AFib, but how we stratify the risk of stroke, and then thinking about anticoagulation. And then really the big thing for our patients who are younger, newer AFib with structural heart disease, or the ones we want to really be thinking about aggressive rhythm control and things like ablations. Mm-hmm. And then the snitch about deprescribing mm-hmm. in our older patients and frail. So thank you, Dr. Lam. Any other words for our listeners?
No, I don't think so. You know, I learned a lot putting together this reader, I think just with the updated guidelines. And so I would encourage you all to look at the handout that's in our Google Drive as well, because there are some helpful sources and a diagram that kind of shows the stages of atrial fibrillation. And so just know that that is available for you to reference as well.
Thank you, Dr. Lam. And thank you to all of our listeners. We will see you back next week. Have a wonderful week, everyone.